This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I did mention at the end of last year we've been dealing with some difficult concepts, but I didn't want to take questions at the end of last year, but that if anybody, after thinking in the shiur, I wouldn't like anybody now to suddenly start thinking back and come up with a question. But if anybody has been troubled by anything from last week's shiur and wants to raise it and deal with it before we start with this week, I'd be happy to spend a few minutes on that before we go. Does anybody have anything? Let's see if you have something. There we go. Yeah. Question. You're asking that in the based on the medrash that I referred to last week of the Tana who was given wealth and his wife said, I won't take it because he was given wealth just before Shabbat. He had no money, he couldn't even buy anything for Shabbat. He got this precious stone from heaven and his wife said, give it back, because I don't want to take it now if it comes from heaven's time. Now, to help you with that, I need to tell you another story. And then we'll see the paradox. The other story was the wife of the Shai Gassariya. The Shai Gassariya was a very great rabbinic scholar in the time of the
300 years ago.
And when he took his first position as a rabbi, and they were poor, they were very, very poor, took his first position, came Rosh Hashanah time, the congregation, as is customary, showered them with gifts. And she got terribly upset, and she said to him, I don't want this rabbinical position, let's go somewhere else, let's get out of it, because they're giving us these gifts, and it's going to come from our Olam Haba, why do we need to get it? The same thing you're mentioning that you're worried about, why I don't need these gifts here, I would rather have it in Olam Haba currency. Why be paid here? And he said to him, do you really think that's all the Olam Haba is worth? Do you think it's a few chocolates and a few bowls of flowers? Do you think that's what the Olam Haba is? What is the issue? The issue is, and we'll probably touch on it again this evening. The things we are given that are tools for the task we have to play, for the task we have to fulfill, do not come from Olam Haba. So anything that an individual needs in order to make his contribution are considered his tools and not his income. If the United States were to appoint you as their ambassador to London, they would give you a very beautiful home to live in. They would not then say, now we're not going to pay you a salary because look, we're giving you a nice place. You would say, a nice place, thank you very much, that's my office, that, I need that house just to be an ambassador. You're not giving it to me for me, you're giving this to me as part of the tools of my trade. I still expect a salary, and you would be quite right. So God gives each of us everything we need to fulfill the role He's planned out for us. That does not come from Olam Haba. If we want more than that, that's where it starts becoming risky. Because then you're looking at taking material benefit as reward rather than as tools. And that becomes difficult. Furthermore, it becomes further difficult if we get it miraculously. If we get it by doing things naturally, we work and there's a certain reward. Although we learned last week that there's not a necessary correlation. Sometimes people work and they don't see the results. And some people don't work and they do see the results. So although there's not a necessary correlation, where it becomes problematic is when it's miraculous. So if we get miraculous, the real miracle, not even winning the lottery, that's not even the kind of miracle I'm talking about, but something coming from heaven. There we've got a reason to be worried about. So the two examples we gave are the one where the rabbi took the students into the valley and all the gold came pouring into the valley and he said, well, decide, do you want your Olam Haba or do you want the gold coins? When it's that kind of miracle, then you have to worry that maybe it's coming from Olam Haba. But if it's a normal, it certainly appears to be normal in terms of cause and effect, then that's not Olam Haba stuff. And that's just something that is natural and normal and God's given it to you to do something with. And that's going to be your question all the time. When you get something, your question has to be, what can I do with this? Why has God given this to me? What, in what way Can I enhance my contribution to the world through the opportunities God's given to me?
And that's not referring only to money. That's referring to all forms of good fortune. But when something good happens, the first thing we should say to ourselves is, how can I use this for Kiddush Hashem? How can I use this to play an even more potent role in bringing God's name into the world? And if you can see a way of doing that, then what God has given you is tools. If God has given you far more than you could possibly use to make any kind of contribution, or you don't choose to make the contribution using that, then there is a possibility that you're taking it off that another. So you choose by the way you relate to it and by the way you see the blessing that you give. Does that help a little bit? Okay. There's a question there somewhere. Yes.
You mentioned about the purpose in life. Last week,
and
now, how do you know that you're fulfilling?
With reference to last week's shiur, where we talked about the fulfilling one's purpose, and again I mentioned a few minutes ago, how do you know what your purpose is? That's something that the Chovas HaVodos, the book called Rabbeinu Bechaya, called The Duties of the Heart, has a whole section on that, on how you work out what you're supposed to be doing in the world. And part of his approach is to analyze the talents and gifts and opportunities you've been given. Because if we go along with what I've just said, that everything we've been given in order to play our role with, then by analyzing what we've been given, we should be able to work out what our role is. What are our talents? What are our strengths? What opportunities have we got that make it easier for us to do some things rather than another? And he gives the example that if a bird looks at itself and says, what am I supposed to do? Well, it's going to say, why has God given me these big flapping things? I'm clearly not supposed to act like a lion or like a monkey. I'm supposed to fly. Otherwise, he wouldn't have given me wings. And each one of us have wings, or we have claws, or we have teeth. And we should figure out from what we have what God wants us to do. Our physical build, our material frame of being, our intellect, our minds, our talents. One should look at the whole constellation and say, a person with this, what should he be doing for God? And then it's quite easy to work it out.
Okay. The question is a little, it's not quite entirely clear, but I'll try.
But is it based on last week's shiur?
I hope so.
Okay.
I'm not even sure about that. There's that expression that God never gives you anything you can't handle. But let's say something is, one of these tests are so difficult that it makes a person to be very bitter, and like people can't really blame them for being bitter. It just seems like it's like a pointless test. I think of the Holocaust as such an obvious example, but.
It isn't directly connected to last week's shiur. I'll just deal with it very briefly by saying that there's no such thing as saying you can't blame a person for being bitter. What you can't blame a person for is the circumstances that meet his life. People find themselves, as we learned last week, in circumstances that are totally beyond their control. Otherwise, sometimes not, but very often people find themselves in circumstances that are beyond their control. What is not beyond their control is what they choose to do about it. And if a person chooses to act like a victim rather than to do something with it, again, if God puts us in a circumstance, it's not a circumstance that's meant to be final, it's a circumstance that is meant to create certain opportunities for us. They might not be the opportunities we want or dreamt of, but they are opportunities that we're meant to explore and grow in. If we choose to take our adversity and grow out of that and master it, that's our choice. If we choose to become bitter, that's our choice too. But you can't say one cannot blame the person for being bitter. One can say one understands the person for being bitter. But at the end of the day, how we choose to react to our circumstance is our own choice. And there are plenty of people around who have had really tough lives, and they're amazing. And there are plenty of people around who have had really easy lives, and they're as bitter as lemons, as sour as lemons, as bitter as mold. And it has nothing to do with the circumstances of their lives. Bitterness and joy and openness, generosity and meanness, these are things we choose. These are not things that are functions of our environment. Yes, circumstances might make it more natural for us to go one way or another. It might make the line of least resistance will be to become bitter. The line of least resistance will be to become mean. But that doesn't mean that we don't have the choice and the ability to overcome the line of least resistance and do something heroic. Every human being has the capacity to do that, and God doesn't put anybody in a position where he cannot be a hero. Sometimes it needs great energy, but he can be a hero. And sometimes that's the very reason God does it, is to elicit from us acts of greatness and acts of heroism.
God expects us to be heroes.
Yes, he does. Sorry to tell you, he does. He does, and he gets disappointed every time we're not. He expects each one of us to be heroes every day of our lives, and to seek out the opportunity for heroism. To actually go into the day and say, where am I going to find the opportunity to be a hero today? Whether it's in helping somebody that I could ignore, whether it's in overcoming something difficult, helping somebody else to overcome something difficult, giving charity at a time where perhaps it's not that easy for me to give it, opening my home at a time that that's not really what I feel like doing, giving time to somebody at a time when I really need the time for myself as well. Now, I'm not saying being a hero to the point of self-destruction. That's not what God wants. But we've all got enough facts to be heroic with, without destroying and annihilating ourselves in the process. And that God wants to see. He wants to see us burning the fat every day. That's what he wants to see. Staying slim and fit and trim. Burning the fat. Taking resources that we've got and don't need, and using them for good things. Although that's not always easy. Every day that's what God wants from us. Yes, he wants us to be heroes every day. Gee, if after 2 years of this year that hasn't come across yet, then I don't know what has. Anybody else that was something around here? No? Well, okay. Right, then let's move into some further material. We spoke last week about the role and the importance of bitachon, of faith. Trust. And we explored the fact that there are circumstances that occur that are beyond our control. And that doesn't mean that we aren't meant to be ambitious and that we aren't meant to strive and to grow and to stretch. We are. Clearly we are. And that's part of the paradox. Part of the paradox that we began to explore last week. That we are meant to strive. There is such a thing as hishtadlus, as putting in all the effort, all the energy that we reasonably can. And yet at the same time, there has to be an acknowledgement of the fact that we cannot always determine the outcome. That we are completely accountable for the amount of effort we invest, but we are not always accountable for the outcome. Sometimes the outcome links to us. Sometimes things go wrong because we were negligent. Then we cannot blame God. Sometimes things go right because we've put in enormous effort. We can take some of the credit for that. But if we analyze the things that go right, we will usually find that they're not directly related. And we gave some examples of where you go after a particular business deal and that's not the one you get. But because you went after that one, other opportunities arose. Because you're out there trying to do something, things come your way that you didn't actually plan and anticipate. It's not that often that a business actually achieves its strategic objectives. But one thing is clear, that a business that doesn't have very clear strategic objectives achieves nothing. And the business with strategic objectives sometimes achieves things that it never dreamed of in its strategic planning. But the fact that it's thinking, the fact that it's searching, the fact that it's looking, the fact that it's examining, it goes and opportunities come. The opportunities are not self-made. I don't think I've ever come across a businessman who said, the opportunities were my brilliance. At best he will say, I made something of the opportunities. But very seldom will he take the credit for the opportunities. You'll always hear him saying, I was lucky, I was fortunate, we had good luck, this happened, this, whatever it was. The coming together of circumstances, that's God. And since no success in a business and in a personal way could happen without opportunities presenting themselves, God is an important partner in every bit of good fortune that we have. And similarly, when things go wrong, God is a partner. Sometimes we're negligent and then we must take complete responsibility, but sometimes we're not negligent. We do our best and it doesn't work. Why? We discussed some of the reasons last week. They're part of a master plan, they're things that are beyond our time frame. There are all sorts of reasons why that happens. But one thing we can be sure, if we're moving on responsibly, whatever we need to do our job, God will provide us with. And the ambassador in London needs a beautiful home. But there's another worker that works for the government, also in London, but his job is to clip newspapers and to pass newspaper reports back to Washington. He doesn't get a house. And he says, well, why is that? The ambassador works for the government, and look at the house he lives in London, and I work for the government, and they don't even give me a house. They don't even give me a car. I go to work on a bicycle in the rain. Is that fair? Yes, it is fair if you regard those items not as rewards, but as tools that are needed for the job that you're expected to do. And each one of us has a role to play, each one of us has a part, has a contribution to make, and we are given whatever we need to make that contribution. And that changes at different phases of our lives. That can change when we change our locations, our situations. The various things that can bring about change, don't always bring about change, but at all times we're given what we need. That faith in God is the first of the Ten Commandments. So the whole principle of the Ten Commandments, which really embodies the whole Torah, both the moral side of the Torah and the religious side of the Torah, its foundation is Anochi Hashem Elokech. I am the Lord, you Lord your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt. You trusted me, I did it, I saw you through that. There needs to be a certain relationship with me where you know that I exist and you trust in my existence. Then we go through the other nine commandments. The last one being Lo Tachmod. You shall not covet. You shall not want something that isn't yours. Ibn Ezra asks, how can you not want something that isn't yours? How can you say to somebody, you shall not want? We can say, you shall not steal. You shall not take. But how can you say, you shall not want? And some of the exponents of the Ten Commandments say, in fact, that Lo Tachmod, that instruction, does not mean you shall not want. It means you shall not take. Don't take something that isn't yours. Don't act on that desire. But Ibn Ezra and others take the view that it means exactly what it says. It is one of the few cases where we are instructed with respect to our emotions, not just our actions. There are a few cases where we are thoughts of idolatry, feelings of idolatry we're not allowed to have. And Lo Tachmod says the Ibn Ezra is one of those feelings we're not allowed to have. Not only aren't you allowed to act on the feeling, but you're not allowed to covet something which isn't yours. Something which isn't yours and which you cannot acquire. That doesn't mean you should not covet something which is in the store. You should not covet something that belongs to somebody else. And the Ibn Ezra learns also that the first commandment and the last commandment are linked. That it's actually a move from the first to the last. And that the one is the expression of the other. Because the Ibn Ezra says, how can you control that feeling? Is it psychologically possible to tell somebody you shouldn't want? So you see your friend driving by in that most magnificent car that you've always wanted, and it's not even available, and you look at it, you just say, I wish I had it. Bang! Tenth commandment, you've transgressed. Is that possible? Can that be what the Tenth Commandment means? Says the Ibn Ezra, yes, because the example he gives is if a peasant from a poor family in a rural village sees a princess drive past in a carriage, he doesn't think to himself, he doesn't fall in love with the princess. So it doesn't happen. Why not? Because she's unattainable. Men fall in love with women who are difficult to attain, but not who are unattainable, says the Ibn Ezra. And therefore, the only way that you can control the desire for something that isn't yours is if you believe it can never be yours. If one understands the boundaries and one says, this is something I can never have, then we become emotionally detached from it. The emotional attachment is only there if one sees some possibility of acquisition, of acquiring it for oneself. Never explains the Vilna Gaon, explains it even more explicitly. You must therefore believe that there are barriers that you can never cross. For example, what God has decreed you will not have, you will never have. You've got to believe that in order to be able to live Lo Tachmot. You cannot stop ambition, and ambition is a positive thing. So you want more, the natural desire for more, the natural desire to grow, the natural desire to expand. That's normal and natural, nothing wrong with that. But how do you stop it at a certain point and say, yes, I want more and I want to expand, but not that, that yes, that not, that yes, that not. How do you do that? Says the Ibn Ezra, only when you understand that there are certain things you cannot have. Why can you not have it? If you believe that the outcome is the result of your effort, you can have anything.
Never forget, that was one of my first real experiences as a child of a real powerful American businessman. I was standing in a hotel in Europe, and the American businessman was having some trouble with the hotel manager, and was asking for some kind of service which the manager said was impossible. He said, alright then, I'll buy this place. There is no limit. If one has the money, if one has the capacity, if one believes that there's nothing I cannot achieve with my own efforts, then one has to achieve, that one has to believe that I can get whatever I want. And now we're looking at something quite interesting, because to say everything's in God's hands and we can never get beyond what God has set aside for us, and we've just got to be satisfied with what He gives us, this empowers us totally and makes us functions of circumstance. And then we might as well lie on the beach, or just sit and read, or learn, or do what we want, and God will take care of us. If we say, on the other hand, that we have to do it, and that our own efforts are what counts, we move into the area where ambition transgresses Lo Tachmot, where you start wanting things that you cannot have, where you start wanting things that you should not have. What is the balance? And here we deal with the paradox. The balance is, God has set aside a whole lot of good things for me. If I work and I toil and I'm productive, I can access those good things that God has set aside for me. If I am not productive, I will not access them. But one thing I know for sure, I cannot access more than God has set aside for me. And there are certain things I can know for sure He didn't set aside for me, because they belong to you. They're not mine. And that way explains the Ibn Ezra, if belief in God and trust in God is firmly entrenched, then Lo Tachmot, the transgression, the prohibition of coveting that which you cannot get, becomes easier to understand. And we're able to invest all of our energies in the creation of wealth rather than the taking of wealth. Lo Tachmot means to take something that isn't yours. Hishtadlus means to create something that will become yours. And that's the difference. And if we are creating, then we are partners with God. If we are taking, we are not partners with God. And we referred to a medrash, I think I mentioned it briefly last week, I certainly mentioned it in Shul a week or so ago, a medrash that dealt with the difference between the gifts that God gives us and the things we take for ourselves. We can take things that God has not given us. We can steal from the universe. We can steal from one another. If I steal your assets, I have them. I cannot say God wanted me to have them, otherwise how would I have them? No, God did not want me to have them, and I have them nevertheless. I have overruled God. God has given us the power to overrule Him. We can take more than He set aside for us, but we're not allowed to do that. It's not truly ours, that's stolen. And so we've got to see our ishtaglus, all our efforts have to be in the creation of wealth, not in the taking of wealth, not in the taking of something that belongs to somebody else. It's interesting, in Jewish law, the laws of competition are so interesting. The Chazodish gives the beautiful example of what bitachon really means. And he paints this picture. He does it in a beautiful little work that he wrote that very few people even know about. It's a little safer, it's about 60 pages. With essays, or it's really one essay written in artistic form, it's almost poetic, and it's called Emunah V'Tachon, belief and trust, belief and faith. And he has a little paragraph there where he paints what Bitachon is, and he paints the picture of a religious Jew, a really religious Jew, and he paints this picture so beautifully. a Jew who's a shul every morning, who's a shul every evening, and he learns, and he goes to shiurim, and he's honest, and he's telling everybody, Mitzvah Hashem and Baruch Hashem, and he brings his children up in Torah, and with faith, and trust in God, and everything will be all the right things, and you just get this picture of this perfect Jew. And then a competitor opens across the road, and you start to worry. And what's he going to do? And there's a competitor, and how's it going to affect his business? And as I mentioned last week, he starts becoming ruthless towards that competitor. And the Chazon Ish holds this person up as the epitome of contradiction, as the epitome of inconsistency, and even worse than that, of hypocrisy. Because the very foundation of Jewish existence is the understanding that God sets limits, and we cannot cross those limits. Doesn't mean we get that automatically. Setting limits doesn't mean God just dishes things out to us. God just sets limits. He creates the opportunities for us to achieve those limits, but he never encourages us to exceed those limits. And if we understand that, we've also got to understand that nobody can take away what is mine. If I am productive and I am working and I'm doing my thing and I'm living the life I should be living, nobody can take away what is mine. Those are the boundaries that are put up. You see, security requires boundaries. And a sense of boundarylessness, as exciting as it is in concept, creates insecurity, and the insecurity creates immorality. People start doing funny things when they feel threatened. And people feel threatened when they don't have walls around them. Now, in South Africa, where I come from, people have walls around their houses, and they have walls around their gardens, and they now have walls around the walls of their gardens. That's how insecure they feel. But even in safe societies, people don't sleep out in the open. They don't just live on. They don't just buy a plot of land and live there, even if the weather would allow it. They put up walls. People need privacy. People need security. They need a place that is demarcated, a place that others don't just walk into, a place that others don't invade. We need to know that there are certain things that others cannot get at. Children have that very strongly. They need to know that there's a place they have, their room, a box, a bed, a corner, that nobody will touch. Otherwise, they start feeling threatened and insecure, and they start doing funny things. And we do the same. Very important for us to know that there is security. God has put up fences. We cannot go beyond those fences, and nobody can come into those fences. Then we can start relaxing. That doesn't mean, once again, and I need to stress over and over again, that doesn't mean that automatically we get everything within those boundaries. We have to work very hard and focusedly to get what's within those boundaries. But nobody else can take that, and we cannot get anything beyond that. Once we've got that in place, then we can have a sense of lo tachmud, of not wanting things that aren't ours, things that cannot be ours and that should not be ours. It's interesting to compare the difference between the sins that caused the destruction of the first temple and the sins that caused the destruction of the second temple. Because the first temple, the Gemara says in Yuma, Mikdash Rishon Mipnei Macharav. What was the reason that the first temple was destroyed? It was such a great generation. What went wrong there? The Gemara says, Mipnei Gimel Dvorem Shehoyuba. Three things they did wrong. Only three. Which three? Number one, Avodah Zarah, idol worship. Number two, Gilui Aroyos, sexual immorality. Number three, Shvichas Damim, murder. Those were the only three things they did wrong. Avah Mikdash Sheni, but the second temple, Shehayu Oskim B'Torah U'Mitzvos U'Gemilas Chasadim, the second temple, they learned Torah, they did mitzvahs, and they were kind, they did chesed, they gave charity. A much better society. Why was that destroyed? Because there was unbased hatred. People resented one another for no valid reason. And the Gemara says to teach us that unfounded hatred is as serious as those three sins. Those are the three sins for which we have to give our lives. Idol worship, immorality, and murder. And to hate one another for no valid reason is as serious as those three sins are. But the Gemara adds on and says, but as wicked as the people in the first temple were, Tolu bitchonam ba'kadosh baruch hu, they trusted in God. And they believed no harm would ever come to them. And the result of that, we're told, is that the period in between the two temples was very short, 70 years. Whereas the second temple's destruction has lasted until today. So, as serious as those three sins were, there was something about that generation that was not as sustainable in its devastating destructiveness as the sin of the second temple. The sin of the second temple was only one thing: unfounded mistrust of one another, unfounded hatred of one another. What we're seeing is, let me give you a statement of the Vilna Gaon. We're showing the first ones, where there was idol worship, immorality, and murder, but they trusted in God. What emerges is bad actions, terrible deeds they did, deeds they should rather have died for than commit, but they had good hearts. They had good hearts because there was trust in God. And that means they didn't hate or resent one another. Whereas the latter ones did all the right things. Their actions were fine. From the outside you would see nothing wrong. They kept the Torah, they did the mitzvahs, they learned, they studied, they gave charity. But internally there was a problem. They resented one another. So there was an honesty in the first temple that there wasn't in the second temple. There was an internal at peace, or actions that weren't in order in the first temple, but in the second temple the actions were all fine, but the soul was missing. The bitochen, bearing in mind what we explained, that bitochen, trust in God, the first of the Ten Commandments and the last of the Ten Commandments. If there's trust in God, not only is the man-God relationship right, but it allows for a peaceful social relationship, because there's a sense of security. You're not a threat to me. If you're not a threat to me, I can start respecting you. I don't have to fear you. Once we remove that belief and trust in God, then I've got to believe that I am master of my own destiny. If I am master of my own destiny, that means I could, with skill and slyness, take away everything you've got. I could do that. Then immediately you become a competitor. And immediately I view you as a competitor. And that undermines the personal relationships among the people. In the first temple there was no such undermining. The belief in God was such that nobody saw the other as a destructive force, as a competitive force. Second temple, religious observance, but there was an internal fear of one another, an insecurity with one another, a feeling threatened by one another, and that caused them to undermine one another. It's interesting to see where the exiles took place. The Jews after the first temple were exiled to three nations: Yavon, Greece, Madai and Bavel. Babylon, Madai and Greece, Yavon. There are verses in Daniel and the Medrash and Vayikra plays with them that compares Bavel to the camel. The image of Babylon is the camel. The image of Madai is the hare, and the image of Yavon is the rabbit. What's common between those three? Very interesting. What's common between those three? They all chew the cud but have no cloven hoof. If you look at the signs of kashrus, what are the signs of kashrus? A kosher animal is an animal that chews the cud but has a cloven hoof. What's the connection between that? Chewing the cud means the animal can manage on much less, because the animal digests it over and over and over again. An animal that doesn't chew the cud constantly needs new consumption, and so he's given claws with which to do that. So you've got it in the animals that are not kosher, you've got feet that are designed to run great distances and to claw, to catch prey. They need to consume. The kosher animal has a sense of being able to dwell with what he's got, to sit with what he's got, to digest it over and over again. So he has the cloven hoof, clearly not designed for speed, clearly not designed for covering great distances in short times, and clearly not designed to kill and to grab. It's not a grabbing kind of a foot. So the kosher animal is an animal whose internal and external is aligned along the lines of being able to define a boundary, to live within an area, as domestic animals do, to be able to find their food in that area, and to be able to chew it over and over again. Those three animals, the camel, the hare, and the rabbit, chew the cud, but they haven't got cloven hoofs. Strange animals. What does that mean? That internally they have the properties. Externally they don't. If you look at the outside of a rabbit, the camel, or the hare, you know it's not kosher. But internally it has the properties. Very similar to what the Jews of the first temple were doing. Internally they had the properties. Externally they didn't. The second temple found the exile from the second temple, in which we're still involved today, is among Edom. Edom are the descendants of Esau, of Esau. They're scattered all over the Western world today. And that's where we find ourselves. And Edom in Daniel is compared to the Chazir, to the pig. And why the pig? Well, he's also not consistent. The pig does not chew the cud, but he does have a cloven hoof. So those four animals are animals who are not aligned. The three are not aligned in the sense that their internal is kosher but their external isn't. And the chazir is not aligned, the pig is not aligned, because his external is kosher but not his internal. And what we find is that's where we are today. We're among the nations of the chazir. We're among the nations that value the external, because that's why the temple was destroyed, because we were functioning with externals. We're among nations of the external, nations that value the external, with the internal absent. The Gemara says, the Yerushalmi says, that every generation in which the temple is not rebuilt is as responsible as the generation in which the temple was destroyed. Because if we would repair what caused the destruction, then the temple would be rebuilt. The fact that the temple hasn't been rebuilt means we're still living with the same flaw that existed at the time of the destruction. And that flaw is we're buying right into the culture. The measures externals, the values externals, that relates to externals, and the internal is completely absent. And that becomes interesting altogether if we just take that one step further. There's a beautiful Gemara that analyzes a verse in the 13th chapter of Yirmiyahu, where God talks about his crying, his depression, his sadness. And the Gemara says in Chagigah, and Omar asks the Gemara, "Umi iko bechiyo kame HaKadosh Baruch Hu?" Does God cry? Then he's not a baby. Why would God cry? "V'Omar Rav Papa, did Rav Papa not teach us? Ein atzevus lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is no depression in God. God is never depressed. Shneimar, as it says, "Hoid v'hodol lefonov. There is glory and grandeur before him. There is power and joy wherever he is." Answers the Gemara, Lekashi, that's not a question. Externally, there is joy and power. Deep inside God, he cries. So we have here a tension between even God having an inside and an outside, so to say, having a soul and an external manifestation. But very often he manifests himself with the joy and the power, but there's a part of him inside that cries. Reb Chaim Volozhiner comments that those who destroyed the temple, Nebuchadnezzar and Titus, would not have been able to do so at all, because the temple was tied to forces in heaven. There's no way that they could have done that. Our deeds weakened God's power to support the temple. And that gave Nebuchadnezzar and Titus the power to destroy the temple. So where's the real accountability? And here comes the essence of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is not about those wicked Romans and those wicked Greeks and those wicked Babylonians who destroyed our temple. That's not what it's about. By the time they got to the temple, it was a structure without a soul. By the time they got to the temple, it had no reinforcement. It was easy for them to blast it away. It had no power. Who removed the power of the temple? We did. We, by removing our own souls from our own religious practice, removed the soul of the Beis HaMikdash. And once the soul of the Beis HaMikdash no longer existed, it was easy for Titus and for Nebuchadnezzar to blast it away. We were the destroyers of the temple. And one has to be very careful that we don't allow Tisha B'Av to turn into a kind of an internal vendetta against anti-Semitism. Tisha B'Av is a very internal time. It's a time that's introspective. We look at our souls and we say, how could we have allowed it to happen? What have we done within our own society that made this possible? How did we allow the temple to be destroyed? What is it that we're still doing that isn't allowing it to be rebuilt? And if we look at that second temple, what it is that we did then is what we're doing just now, is buying into the culture of Rome, buying into the culture of Edom, buying into the culture of Esav, the culture where all that is important is the external. Instead of being able to balance the two, the kosher animal is not the animal who has the internal without the external either. The kosher animal is the animal that has the balance between the two, where the internal and the external are perfectly matched. And matched in what area? In the lo tachmud. The ability of the kosher animal to set its limits and to know that it's not going to be able to grab something that doesn't belong to it. It is not going to be able to take another animal's life. It is not going to be able to sustain itself through the destruction of others. It's going to eat food that God has provided it. And it will work that food over and over again, extracting all the nutrition it can to make sure that it's able to survive as a result of that. And so as we face these days of Tisha B'Av, it's important for us to understand what it is that we're mourning. And we'll discuss that a little bit further in the short shiur that we'll have on Tisha B'Av night. We need to appreciate Rabbi Chaim Friedlander explains very beautifully that what does it mean, God crying, God laughing? Does God cry? Does God laugh? They're just words that can't be really associated with God. And he says you've really got to look a little bit deeper at those emotions. When we are depressed, the first thing we do is we withdraw. We don't share our depression. We withdraw. We close off. And that's part of the laws of mourning, the very beautiful laws of mourning that we've got is we pull the mourner out. We don't allow him to withdraw. Right after the funeral, we go home with him and we sit there. And even if we don't talk, we sit there. And we're available for him to talk as soon as he wants to talk. And we're there in the morning, and we're there in the afternoon, and we're there in the evening. And we say, you're done with a minyan. And if you don't want to come to a minyan, the minyan will come to you. And if you're not going to come and listen to the Sefer Torah, we bring the Sefer Torah to you. And you will say Kaddish, and we will answer you. You will feel part of a community. That's the beauty of those laws of mourning. We don't allow the person to withdraw. Because the nature of mourning and of depression is withdrawal. The nature of simcha is sharing. When you have a simcha, you want to invite people. And you want to invite as many people as you can afford to have. You want people to enjoy it with. We don't enjoy simchas alone. We enjoy simchas with friends. And so says Reb Chaim Friedlander, God's joy manifests in God's engaging with us. God's sadness manifests in God withdrawing from us. We spoke last week about the difficulties in understanding God because he's so withdrawn. Because he doesn't show us his ways. Because he doesn't show us how he operates. We see people who are good who don't do well. We see people who are bad who do well. We see suffering where there shouldn't be suffering. We see prosperity where there shouldn't be prosperity. We cannot figure it out. And part of the reason that we cannot figure it out is because God has withdrawn. God's way of dealing with us is less obvious. He's not holding our hands. He's not there showing us the way. Why not? Is it because he's angry? No. Is it because he's unfair and unjust? No. It's because he's in mourning. He's sitting shiva. And he's on his own. And he just isn't engaging. Just as anybody else who's in mourning doesn't want to engage. Doesn't want to get into philosophic discussion. Doesn't want to get into a whole explanation of how he operates and what he's doing and what his plans are. He just disengages. And we struggle when God disengages. We can't feel him, we can't see him, we can't sense him. So what are we mourning at this time? A temple? No! Are we mourning a building in Jerusalem? Not at all! We're mourning the loss of an intimate relationship with God. We're mourning that feeling of loss where we can't understand what he's doing and where he's going. Where we know he's there because we're told he's there, but we can't experience him that easily. That's what we're mourning. More direct relationship between cause and effect, at least from a moral perspective, where one could see the connectedness, one could feel God responding. When we did something right, when we did something wrong, we could feel God's response much more directly, and there was a relationship. When God says in his inner chambers he's crying, what he means is he's mourning. And on Tisha B'Av we sit on the floor with dimmed lights and we cry. We cry because of the loss of our own souls, of our own internal mechanisms, of our own spirituality. The structure's in place, but the soul is absent. We're living among nations that value the external, and we've learned from them. We too value and measure the externals. And we're building the externals more and more solidly, ignoring the internals, ignoring what the soul needs, ignoring what the neshama needs. We cry because we mourn the loss of a relationship. We used to be close to God and we can't find him. Why can't we find him? Because he's crying too. On Tisha B'Av, and not only on Tisha B'Av, God, at least in his inner part, is sitting deep in the deep recesses of his own place where he is, with his lights dimmed and tears rolling down his face, to say, craving for the relationship he once had with us, wishing that we could reconstruct our souls and reconnect with him, enabling him to reconnect with us and establish the relationship that both he and we crave. Thank you.